There's more to be discovered. There's more to be found. And that's an exciting message that kids today, young adults, and our generation need to hear. Go explore more.
That's Lee Berger, and I'm Dan Skinner. This is Conversations. Lee Berger is a paleoanthropologist and National Geographic Explorer in residence. He's best known for his discovery of early human ancestors, in addition to being an award-winning author, speaker, and research professor. He joins me to talk about the book Almost Human, which he co-authored with John Hawks. Lee, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
Lee, tell us a little bit about your co-author.
So John Hawks is one of the leading scientists in the field of paleoanthropology. He actually came out of genetics. And he and I sort of met a few years back because we both hold a passionate mutual interest in the open access and open sourcing of science. The field of paleoanthropology, human origins, has largely been a closed science. And John was a champion in the field of communicating that through blogs and other areas. And I was doing it through trying to make fossils that we were discovering actually open together. We came together, and then an amazing discovery of Homo naledi at the Rising Star Expedition occurred in 2013. He came, he worked with me in organizing that team, but also communicating that incredible discovery live to the world, the richest hominid site ever discovered. And so it became a natural fit to work together.
Well, before we learn more about that discovery, tell us a little bit more about yourself. You know, as you describe in your book, you've been interested in exploration ever since your childhood.
Oh, absolutely. I grew up in rural Georgia. I was born in Kansas, but grew up in rural Georgia, truly rural Georgia, in the wilderness. And I always had a passion in things in the outdoors and collecting things, Native American artifacts and plowed fields, fossils. And that drove me to have this keen interest, but I didn't see that as a future. For when you grow up in rural Georgia, if you're a bright kid, you kind of only have a couple of options, you know, doctor, lawyer, engineer in front of you as possibilities. I went to university to start that, to be a lawyer. I hated it, but I took these electives in geology and suddenly realized there's a career path there. And investigating further, found that you could actually, there was this science called paleoanthropology, the search for human origin. And best of all, it was in Africa. And even better, it was one of the hardest sciences in the world. It had one of the smallest, rarest records. And that just intrigued me, and I was addicted.
Now, you live in Johannesburg, and I understand that this discovery back in 2008 was really not far from home.
Well, I'm actually sitting as I speak, watching the sunset over a region called the Cradle of Humankind, a UNESCO World Heritage Site, in the middle of where these discoveries are made. In 2008, my then 9-year-old son found the first piece of what would lead to be an incredible discovery, one of the richest in the world, of Australopithecus sediba at a site called Malapa, a 2-million-year-old hominid. That was, for me as a paleoanthropologist, you know, the ultimate win of a lottery ticket. It was skeleton after skeleton. No one had made discoveries like that. I had no idea, though, that just a few years later, 5 years later, I would be looking at images from a deep 200-foot underground cave of another discovery that would turn out to be of even greater importance and greater magnitude.
Well, what led up to that discovery?
So I had done a survey back in 2008 using Google Earth, and that had plotted hundreds and hundreds of cave sites that scientists hadn't known about in this very region. In 2013, I was actually kind of locked out of working at Malapa because we were building a laboratory over it. And I enlisted a former graduate student and two amateurs to search in deep underground, hard-to-get-to environments that these cave entrances I'd mapped led to. And on September 13th, they went into a deep, well-known cave system, found a 7.5-inch slot about 150 feet underground, and they skinnied down 60 feet of this 7.5-inch slot, dropping into a chamber, and there they saw bones. They brought those pictures back to me. I knew immediately what it was. I thought it was a skeleton of a primitive hominid. I launched the Rising Star Expedition, a 60-person expedition, in November of 2013. 21 days later, we had the richest fossil hominid site in history.
The fascinating thing to me about this story is just physically how hard it was to get to these specimens. You had to get some people who were very small in stature to be able to slide into that space?
I had no idea how I was going to get in. I was not physiologically appropriate to get into this chamber to get through a 7.5-inch slot. So I needed skinny scientists with PhDs who had experience in digging and climbing and who were willing to risk their lives. And so I put a Facebook ad out. And 10 days later, I had 60 qualified applicants, 80% young women, selected six extraordinary scientists who just happened to be women, and we launched that expedition, that extraordinary moment for us. And that's the journey that we take the reader through in this book, both that history, but through this exciting adventure that sometimes science is privileged to be.
So is that frustrating for you, though, since you were not actually able to physically get there?
Yes. You know, it also was a challenge. It was a challenge to develop technology, to find people with the skills and training to do that. That had extraordinary satisfaction. And, of course, we found another chamber almost just like it, just a little easier to get into. It had about 9.5-inch squeeze, of which I could get into once. I got stuck coming out for an hour and have never been back in. But I've been in one of these chambers with Homo naledi in them. So that makes up for it a little bit.
Well, tell us more about this new species. Where does this fall in sort of the what we envision as that sort of order of evolution?
So one of the important things about both Sidiba and Homo naledi is they've told us, even though they are both extraordinary discoveries with rich, rich fossils, more than anyone else has had, is perhaps we shouldn't try to make those predictions right now. Because what they tell us is that story is more complex than we had ever thought. We thought initially, you know, evolution was like a ladder, then it was like a tree, then a bush. Now it's probably more like a braided string. And things like Naledi say you need to be really careful about trying to shove things into boxes in that tree. Now, Naledi is primitive. It's primitive in our genus. It's one of the most primitive ever found. That it should have existed 2 to 3 million years ago, if our storyline had been right, and that's probably when the species originated. We just announced 2 weeks ago, of course, that Homo naledi, this population, is only 200,000 to 300,000 years old. That's extraordinary because it meant, firstly, the species was there all along and invisible to us for millions of years, but then also this species of non-human, a small-brained, primitive species with ape-like arms and long, skinny legs, possibly met modern humans.
You say this is really complicated in that it's not a straight line. Different species may have coexisted at the same time, which is a fascinating thing to think about.
Well, and it also is going to be sort of traumatic but exciting for things like archaeology. Because think about being a young archaeologist right now. If you stare at the archaeological record of Africa of the last several hundred thousand years, when we thought it till now it was only modern humans doing it, we won't know who made what tools. You can't just assume because Homo naledi had a tiny brain that it was incapable of doing very complex things, particularly since we've proposed Homo naledi is actually deliberately disposing of its dead, which is something we thought only modern humans do.
Well, I'd like to talk more about that. How did you reach this conclusion? I know part of it was the fact that you did discover two chambers, and you saw that there were, you know, similarities between those two chambers. So it wasn't just a one-off that you discovered in that first chamber.
So during the expedition, almost by the end of the first week, we realized something was really strange about this accumulation. We were all professional archaeologists and paleontologists, and what was coming out of the chamber was the richest load of hominids ever. It was hominid bone after hominid bone after hominid bone. No one had ever seen that in a fossil hominid site in all of history. There are always other animals and stuff with it. There were also no marks of scavengers or predators. There was no sign that the bodies had been washed in there. They hadn't been killed or crushed by anything. And after studying that chamber, we called the Naledi chamber, that first assemblage, we came to the conclusion that there was no better hypothesis than this was a deliberate body disposal. Now, if it had only been human skeletons, by the way, no one would have had a problem with that. But no one could see a fossil human relative with a brain the size of an orange doing that. Then we found a second chamber. A second chamber almost identical to this one, in fact, better preservation in some ways, equally hard to get to, with all the same sort of features. And I think that does add substantial weight to the idea of deliberate body disposal in this non-human species of animal. And that's something, because that used to be only our gig. That was what we humans had. And other animals didn't. It was about the last thing that separated us from the animal world.
That's what amazes me about it, is even though you describe them as having a very small brain, it was still a large enough brain to grasp this concept of wanting to treat the dead with some level of respect, which is part of what makes us human.
That's right. We try to deal with this a little bit in the book, but, you know, without being cliched, Homo Naledi truly says size doesn't matter, at least when it comes to brains, and that it's likely that they're achieving very complex behaviors, but with a smaller, differently organized brain than ours. You know, we understand very little about why we have a big brain. What Homo Naledi tells us, particularly with it being so recent in time, is that that big brain was not an inevitable march of evolution.
Do you think there's the possibility of more of this species out there just needs to be somehow discovered?
Oh, absolutely. I think there'll be more. I think we possibly already found it, but people haven't found enough of it to recognize it. And also, you might have noticed in the book, in the epilogue, we give you a little teaser. We didn't stop exploring. We've made other spectacular discoveries, which we're busy investigating right now.
You were saying that maybe this was discovered in the past, but in little bits and pieces. And since they didn't know it existed, they assumed maybe it was something else. Is that what you were saying?
That's the curse of paleontology. You know, when you find what paleontologists have tended to do in the past is be very conservative. So when you find something and can describe it and see it, they name a species. Then typically they assign almost everything found that doesn't vary too far from that, a tooth, a finger bone, a piece of a leg bone, to that species, unless evidence proves otherwise. That's going to be the big contribution of complexity that Homo Naledi offers, being so young. Because from now on, you can't assume your species is alone.
So describe this species to us. So what do we think it looked like?
So imagine, if you will, if you were walking across a savanna landscape and saw a group of Homo Naledi, what at a distance they look like humans, but small, skinny ones. If you got closer, though, you'd realize that they're not at all humans. They have a tiny pinhead-sized brain, about the size of an orange, and that is really small, about a third the size of a small human brain. Their teeth would have been primitive in their shape, but small like a human's. They would have had almost a snouty look to them, maybe a little bit approaching that of what you see in a not-so-prognathic chimpanzee. Their shoulders were very ape-like, but their arms became more and more and more human-like to reach a very human-proportioned hand, but with very curved fingers. Their pelvis would have been wide and flaring, not bowl-shaped like ours. And then they would have these long, skinny, human-like legs with human-like feet on the end of them. Really a strange, strange mix of primitive and advanced characters.
You know, I hear the excitement in your voice, and it makes me think that there is so much more for us to discover, that you've had the good fortune of making these great discoveries, but it sounds like there's a lot more that you might discover in the future.
Well, absolutely, and I would hope that your listeners, if they read the book, and I hope they get a sense of this, if you're passionately involved in the science, you're going to get a lot of the insider background, why we made decisions, but we wrote the book so that it would particularly be easy to read for even young people to read it, to hope to act as an inspiration to you with the message that these discoveries were found in one of the most explored areas on planet Earth, right under our nose. There's more to be discovered. There's more to be found. And that's an exciting message that kids today, young adults, and our generation need to hear. Go explore more.
Lee, thank you for talking with me today.
Oh, absolutely. My pleasure.
Lee Berger's book, co-authored with John Hawks, is Almost Human. More information and more interviews on a wide variety of topics are available at kpr.ku.edu/conversations. You can also hear the interviews on our KPR app for smartphones. Conversations is a production of Kansas Public Radio. I'm Dan Skinner. Thanks for listening.